Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Holly, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm real pleased to be with you. I was thinking this afternoon about a little story that I heard not too long ago, and it certainly reminds me very much of people like us. It's about a man, two men rather. One liked to pick on the other, and one of them had gotten sober and was doing pretty well. He'd gone back to church and doing very nicely. Pretty well satisfied with himself. And his friend, who was jealous of him. Now, of course, you know, we always find people that don't try too very hard at times, and they get a little jealous of those who do try, and so they won't slap you down. So this particular man started picking on this man about his religion, because I don't see what he went wrong with that church for, and all that sort of stuff. And the man began to say the Serenity Prayer, but he kept on after him anyway. He said, "Man, another thing, I heard you belong to AA." He said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Well, I don't see how you stand that organization. That's terrible." He said, "You know, tell me about it." He says, "Well, come with me and I'll show you." "But no," he says, "You know," he says, "with all those people in there," he says, "it must be something like Noah's Ark." He says, "just like when the Ark was crowded with people." He says, "there had to be some gossip going on." He said, "with all those animals in there, there had to be some filth." He said, "so AA, that thing you belong to must be something like Noah's Ark." He said, "well, come to think of it, you know, it really is like Noah's Ark in a way." He said, "we do have some gossip a little. We do have some filth, a little." He said, "but like Noah's Ark, everybody that stays in it stays dry." So, that what you and I work toward with the help of Almighty God and each other is to have sobriety. Not just being dry, but to stay sober also. Now, I really and truly don't have any way out fantastic story to tell you, because first and foremost, I do not believe in deifying my drunkenness. I'd like to, shall we say, give glory to this program. And because there's nothing glorious about puking, you know. And I don't have a spectacular story to tell you that, shall we say, that would send your head whirling about my drinking. I started drinking when I was about 14 years old, and I think that, in fact, I know I took my first drink out of curiosity. My grandparents, I grew up in their home. I won't say they raised me, because nobody couldn't raise me. And my life's always been unmanageable, still is. And I used to see my grandfather. My grandparents were teetotalers, but my grandfather had a bottle of whiskey there that he kept in the dresser drawer, but it had a whole lot of rock candy in it and herbs and all that kind of junk. And on rainy, wet days, he had, when his rheumatism got real bad, he would cripple over to this drawer with this bad leg of his, and he'd pull that drawer out and he'd pound. And he'd take two or three swigs out of that bottle, and he'd rub his leg, you know. And he'd walk away. He'd come pretty good. And I had watched my grandfather do this on numerous occasions, and I wondered, now, any time he cripples over there like that and takes two or three swigs, there'll be something to it. So one day I walked over there, and I took two or three swigs out of it and sat down, and I crippled away. And I can remember him telling my grandmother, he says, "dear, you know, alcohol really is beginning to evaporate. Not like it used to be, it evaporates." No, I was growing up, and it did evaporate. And I loved the taste of it. I did at that time. And most people, you'll hear many people say, "well, I didn't like the taste of it." Well, that's them, but I did. I was born and raised in a little small town in Ohio. And lots of times we had that corn whiskey from Kentucky, that, you know, that crying whiskey, the kind that you drink and it makes tears run out of your eyes, and you say, "oh, God, ain't it good?" And you stand and drink it and cry. So I know all about that kind of whiskey. And then, once I got a taste for it, I can't ever say that I was a social drinker. I don't believe I ever was a social drinker. In fact, I really don't know what a social drinker is. I heard that a social drinker was a person that could say no thank you to a free drink. Maybe I guess that is it. I don't know. But this alcoholism of mine started quite early, and it continued quite late, and I am a very grateful person that I have sense enough even to be here. Sometimes I doubt my sanity. I've doubted it in the last couple of days because I still can't find that room they gave me over there. Every time I go look for it, they hide it somewhere else. Well, it started out like that. But you know, the big book says our stories reveal in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. You know, I like to talk about what happened. What I used to be like, I was a drunkard. That's exactly what it was, a drunkard. You know, an alcoholic from the word go. Well, what happened was this. I'll tell you what happened. One night, I was sitting in my kitchen. And this was a miracle, because it was on a Saturday night. That's the reason I'm always thrilled when somebody asks me to talk on a Saturday night, you know. Makes you feel good. Because I didn't have any sober Saturday nights very many. And this particular Saturday night, a story came on over the radio, and it was called The Glass Crutch. Now, I did not turn that radio onto that station, because when you have become a wino, well, women aren't winos, they're winettes. When you have become a winette, you do not turn the radio on to the station, on the inner station. You buy one and you plug it in and it plays because you're so used to hearing voices that you don't make a difference whether the radio or not. You hear them all that minute. And this story came on. This is what happened. This story came on over the radio and it was about a woman that had a drinking problem. Now, I don't remember any of the ingredients of that story, but I do remember this. It said, if you ever need our help, we'll be the first number in the book, in the phone book they were talking about. And the name of that story was called The Glass Crutch. Now, if it had been a story about a man, I wouldn't pay any attention to it one way or the other, because all the men I knew were alcoholics. They seemed to be. They seemed to be, anyway. I don't know whether they were or not, but I drank with them. Nevertheless, the first thing that hit my mind was this. If that woman would just quit drinking whiskey and get some wine, she wouldn't be in that condition. I'll never need him. If there's anything wrong with me, I'll straighten myself out if there's anything wrong with you. If any of you people have ever read The Hound of Heaven, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, I heard that story 6 or 7 years prior to my coming into the fellowship. Not every day, not every week, not every month. But you know, those words would come back to me from time to time. The glass crutch. I can remember walking down the street and it seemed as if the heel plates on my shoes would beat out the words, the glass crutch. At other intervals, it seemed to me that the clock on the wall didn't say tick-tock. It said the glass crutch, the glass crutch. It haunted me. It bugged me. It worried me. And I would drink that much more. Why in the world? Are these words annoying me? And finally, one day, I was sitting in the living room trying to read a newspaper, and it seemed as if every word on that newspaper said the glass crutch. And I said, my Lord, what does this mean? And it dawned on me exactly what it did mean. Holly, you cannot even read the newspaper without the glass crutch, because there I sat trying to read the newspaper, hit upside down with a glass of wine. Yeah? Now, it would sound dramatic to say I dropped the glass and I ran quickly, you know, and to the phone or phone book and looked up the number, but I didn't know such thing as that. Still, that old arrogant, belligerent person, if there's anything wrong with me, I can straighten it out, you know. After all the hell that I have gone through, I can still straighten it out. No, no. But finally, 24, 48 hours that day, I don't know what. I went to the phone book and I looked. There it was, just as they said it would be, the first number in the book. You know? Well, I called the number up, and being a pathological liar, I told the woman, I said, you know, I got a friend out here. I think she's losing her mind. I said, would you send somebody out to talk to her? And my tongue was about that thick, and she said, would you like to have somebody talk to you? Oh, no. Well, 24, 48 hours, I don't know. Later, I called back, and I told her that she asked me, she said, if you got a drinking problem, all I can do is say my name is Holly. There's something wrong. You got a drinking problem. I don't know. I think so, but I'd like to talk to somebody. She asked me what was my last name. I wasn't going to tell her that. And she asked me where I live, and I wasn't going to tell her that either. And, well, I had to hold on to some dignity, you know. Finally, I did tell her, and she said, well, I'll have somebody call you. This is what happened, my friend. What I used to be like is not important, but what happened is. Okay. She had a woman call me, and this lady, bless her heart, she was sweet, I guess. She said, because I hated all my sponsors at first. She said, now, if you've got anything to drink out there, get rid of it. I did. I drank it up right there. And I had, by this time, reached the stage of zombieism. And that is, if you drink, you don't get drunk. And if you do drink, or don't drink, then you don't get sober either. You're just like a zombie. And this began to frighten me, you know. See, I'd heard about, I didn't know what a blackout was until I came into AA. I really didn't know. I'd had them, but I didn't know what they were. I just thought I was losing my mind on installment plans. I didn't know anything, something like that. Okay, but you know, the very time, alcohol is everything the big book says it is, cunning, baffling, and powerful. The very time I would better stayed like a zombie, then what happened? The lady told me what time of the evening she'd be out. And you know, you and I, we always get nervous when somebody's coming to see us, and I got nervous. And just about 45 minutes before time for this lady to come to call on me, a couple of my good, lifelong friends come by, and they gave me a couple of drinks. It was famous corn coal on the dying embers. It revived up all this stuff I drank. But you know, she took me to that meeting. And I guess I must have looked so bad there that three other gals jumped up and said, we'll help you with her. They thought they were going to be my pallbearers, I guess. I don't know. But I was one hell of a mess, I'll tell you that. But you know, there was something about those women. They loved me, and I hated them. I despised. Because, you know, every time I went to lie, they'd look at me and say, And every time I try to climb, you know, well, little girl, you just stick around. You know, one of those kind of things. But one of them, she was a feisty old broad, you know. Lady, rather. She always was hauling this hoolie out on me, you know. And she'd say, now, just answer yes to three, dear. Here I am. I said, so Billy must be getting 50 cents a yes or something. I don't know. She'd pull out. Now, is drinking clouding your reputation? Well, if you've been in there, this is the kind of things that went through my mind at that time. Well, if you've been in a fog 27 years, how do you know whether it's cloudy or foggy? It doesn't make any difference one way or the other. Then she'd come on with another. Do you think a lower environment while drinking? I thought, hell no, I merely create a lower environment while drinking. And then she asked me one of the dumbest questions that you can ask a practicing alcoholic. Do you prefer to drink alone? If I'm buying it, yes. If you buying it, no. But you know, we didn't have all the nice facilities that they have now for people to go and dry out. You know, they just drug you anyway. Sometimes you'd be so sick it didn't make any difference. They just drag you anyway. Those kind of things. And I'm glad. I'm very happy today that I came in AA the way that I did. It's not that I don't appreciate the things that they have for people that are coming in today. I think it's wonderful. But, you know, being an old hard-headed woman like me, I think the treatment that I got was just exactly what I needed. Because it makes my sobriety really dear to me. Never do I want to think of those things again. Of me going through them again. I think about them every day. Because it's bound to come to your mind. Those early days in AA, those days before coming into AA, they're bound to come back to your mind, and they are good for you. It's just like sometimes people wonder, you know, did you ever dream that you got drunk? Yes, I had dreamed that I got drunk. I was dreaming. I have dreamed that I was drinking. Well, what does it mean? I said, it means to take inventory. And that's what it means to me. Anytime I dream that I've been drunk or was about to drink, I take my inventory. I say, oh, Lord, wait a minute. Let me and you get together one more time here, you know. I wouldn't be having this dream for nothing. And I feel that all these things that happen to me and that are happening to me is grace. So I said to my sponsor one day, I said, Mary, where do we go from here? She said, what do you mean, where do you go from here? We stay. She said, just look at your life from now on like you are going on a trip. Well, I've been on enough trips, so I didn't want to look at that. But I like to look at the days that I live now. Since I've learned how, through the grace of God and this fellowship, to stay sober, and I call it my journey into sobriety. So when one starts out on a journey, first and foremost, if he's going to drive, he wants to take his car to a very reputable mechanic. He wants to have it gone over, see that it's in good condition. And sometimes it's very wise that when you and I come into the fellowship, it's well that we see a physician to see that we are all right physically, that we haven't done too much damage to ourselves, so sometimes we've done more than we think that we have. And then again, when one starts on a journey, he needs 4 good tires. It's very necessary before he starts out. And I like to think the 4 good tires that you and I might need. Communication, that you and I can talk with one another, you know. Another good tire is identification. You and I can identify with one another. Another tire is self-examination. I need to look at myself. And that 4th tire is determination. Once I am here and have many blowouts as I've had, I need that determination to hang in here. Now, there's another thing that is of utmost importance for a dummy like me, and that is when one starts out, is to get his journey mapped out for him. In what direction am I going? Well, at home, I don't know what you do here, but at home, we go to AAA, I suppose you do the same thing here. And you tell the man there where you want to go, and he'll get a map, and he'll show you. Now, living in Ann Arbor, Michigan, as I do if I wanted to go to Kentucky, the man very easily, most likely, would tell me, now you just go over here to 23 South, so you get to I-75, and you stay on there, and you'll wind up in Kentucky. Okay? That's true, you will. Same thing the big book says. Rarely have we seen a person fail that has thoroughly followed our path. That's what that man's trying to tell me. Now, if you get on here and stay on here, you're not going to get lost, you know. So he maps it out for you. Chapter 5 got it mapped out for you. There's the answer right there, you know. Then there's another thing as we travel on there. The most disgusting thing that can happen to anybody is when one starts out on his journey, and you get into one of these small towns. Well, don't always have to be small, but you've got, shall we say, out-of-state license. Oh, boy. There's the fuzz ever watch you, you know. You do the slightest thing, they're going to slam a fine on you, and that just ruins your vacation. All the pieces, you know. So it is very well that you and I, as we start on our journey, and our car is in good condition, and we've got on the right track, that we obey the signs that we see along the road. Now, those signs weren't just simply put there, you know, to give the road commission or the county commission something to do. They were put there to be obeyed. Well, it took me a long time to learn that. And I look at those signs along the road, and I identify them with my 12 steps because they were put there for me to obey them. It says they were suggested, you know. Well, yes, they were suggested. But Many times it is well to take a suggestion, too, you know. Well, you say, wait, I have 12 of them there. After all, you know, you're going to find just like this man I first started talking to you about that was always on the other one's back. Well, why is it? Can't you just live by the Ten Commandments? Well, yeah, why is it that you can't? Well, in the first place, you know, the world was mighty sick. And I look at those Ten Commandments, they're beautiful. And Almighty God gave this sick world 10 doses of medicine. But some of us were a little sicker than others, and he had to give us 12 doses, you know? Yeah. So that we could digest them. So these 12 doses of medicine, they're going to get me well. I am on the road to recovery. I am not recovered, I am recovering. Because, you know, that word recovered sounds so final. It sounds like, you know, you can almost hear the top coming down on the casket and somebody patting dirt on it. You know, you're not only covered, you're recovered, you know. I'm not ready for that, you know. So as we travel on our journey into sobriety, one of the most frequent signs that we see along the road is that stop sign. Stop. And I like to identify that stop sign with the first step where we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. The sign there that says stop. You will see no sign that says table off. It says stop. See, you cannot tell the boy when he stops or comes up beside you on that motorcycle, well, Mr. Officer, I was tapering off. You don't want to hear that. He starts writing. And they're not love letters either. What are some of the other stop signs that I ran through? I ran through a great many of those stop signs. Lying, you know, stealing, and hiding. Anytime I get to the place in life where I've got to go out and work and buy something, bring it home, and then lie about it and then hide it, I need to stop. You know? Somebody says, how did that bottle get there? Oh, I don't know. I don't know. You know? And you hide things, whether it's Christmas or not, you're always hiding it, you know. And then lie about it. Lie when the truth would do better. You walk up to somebody and they say good morning and you say, oh, I just had two. Nobody asked you, I mean. But I got to lie. Well, maybe they walk up too close to you and they smell your breath. You say, now wait a minute, now what you smell is toothache medicine. And you got false teeth. Or a partial plate or something like that. Then I gotta hide things. All kinds of places I found to hide things. Hiding things. You need to stop. Gulping. You know that thing when you have company and you go out in the kitchen there, you know you're gonna serve your company and in those little insult glasses, about like that. And you pour a drop or two, an eyedropper in each glass there. But before you take it back, you gulp out the bottle yourself right quick. See? And you gulp it down, and it goes down the wrong way, of course, naturally. And you come back coughing, and you think you've caught TB or something. Your tears run out of your gulping. Now, why did I have to drink that fast, that quick? Because I'm a glutton, because I'm an alcoholic. And I got to have that extra drink. And then I can come in there and sit down, you know, and sip. After gulping. I sip. And then I began to justify my drinking. I must justify. Anytime anybody says, did you have a little bit too much last night? Oh, I got to justify that. See, I've got to. And then you start trying to rationalize. Well, a friend of mine told me about rationalization. We try to rationalize this program. Rationalization, he told me, you know, he said, that's the same as masturbation. You're just screwing yourself. He's right. And then we become preoccupied. That's another stop sign I went through. Preoccupied. Every thought was drinking. Every thought. Well, there was a time, maybe you started out by, at least when I say you, I'm talking about Holly, I'm not talking about you, I'm talking about your drink, I'm talking about mine. Preoccupied, you get up, you know, you can't hardly wait till Friday. Then you get to the place where you can't wait till Thursday. And then you finally get to the place where you can't wait till Thursday, so we start having a little drink at lunchtime. Then you get to the place where you got to have a drink in the morning, and so you say, why wait? You know? So then I just start drinking. That's it. So preoccupied, every thought, the minute you think of going to a person's house, well, I think I'll go to see Nancy. Well, no, hell, she ain't got nothing to drink this time of the week. I ain't going over there then, you know. It's amazing how few people that you stop dancing when you find out they don't have anything to drink. And you say, oh, I just dropped over there to see how you were doing. Now, you didn't care how they were doing. You know, you didn't care what they were doing. About. Now, if they don't say, the minute they say, well, I haven't got anything, well, oh, well, I just stopped in for a few minutes anyway, you know. It's just like when people say, now, well, don't you have anything to drink there for your friend? No, I do not. You are not my friend if you come to see me to see what I got to drink. You didn't come see me. You come see what I got to drink. You say, no, so you're no friend of mine. If you can't drink coffee and tap and stuff like that, go on home. I don't care. It doesn't make me any difference. Because if I have got to buy or keep alcohol to entertain you, you are not my friend, and I don't care that much about your companionship anyway. That I've got to keep you drunk in order to keep your friendship. Isn't that a duck? Oh, no. I learned better than that. And then again, another stop sign that I ran through, and that was constantly creating anxiety in other people to get my own way. You know how you come home, you know, and you wonder why you came home. You was already out there. Now you come home like a fool, and you walk back out, and you haven't got sense enough to say, I'm going out, so you got to start some old cold arguments, you know. Oh, you got to start some argument. Somebody drops a pea in the mashed potatoes. What are you raising all that hell for? And then you start walking the floor and biting your nails. So if somebody says, what's wrong there? You make me nervous. You make me nervous. You say, well, look, why don't you stop praying? Because see, what we really are trying to do is to create enough anxiety in this other person so they'll say, look, will you get the hell out of here? And that's all you want to hear. Yes. I know you don't want me in my own house. See, I know how that goes. You know. So here we are. To keep other people upset so you can give me an excuse to do what I was going to do anyway. Get drunk. I ran through all of those stop signs, my friend, and many more. Every one of them. And as I travel on my journey into sobriety, I see a sign in the road that says, yield. The second step. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Yield. In other words, that step is telling me, you'd better give over before you give out. Yeah. Yield. Give over. See, the big book tells me. See, I love that book. It says we can only be defeated by an attitude of belligerent denial. In other words, yield is a soft, it's a pleasant word. But it means exactly what it says. Have you ever been driving down the highway and you see the sign that says yield? They mean yield. You know? Here you are in a Volkswagen. You say, I ain't going to yield. Here comes a Mack truck tearing around the corner. You know, what the hell you had to yield it to something, you know, one way or the other. Yield. Many times we run into people nowadays more than we used to that seems to have a problem with the spiritual. Well, it's a spiritual part of the program. The whole program is spiritual as far as I'm concerned. But they seem to have a problem with that second step and the third step or anything that has to do with God. In other words, you will hear now many times, oh, don't mention God, you know, because you'll run him away. Where in the hell has he got to go? He's got nowhere to go. He's got nowhere to go. He's got nowhere to go. So that alcohol is going to run him right back in again if he can make it. I'm telling you. So many times we will find people that try to have a substitute. And there is no substitute. There is no substitute. I don't care what you come up with. Because you know what the big book says? Remember, you deal with alcohol. Cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for you. But there's one that has all power, that one is God. It says so in the book, may you find him now. You know, it says so. Well, you know, some people might think, well, I don't buy this God bit. Of course you don't. It's not for sale. It's free. I don't buy this God bit. You know, after all, I go to my psychiatrist, and that bastard just jumped out the window last week. Now, there are some good ones. There are some good ones, but the good ones are all in AA. You know. Or you might hear someone say, well, you know what my doctor said? My doctor and my, well, now that's all right. The doctors are fine people, and those psychiatrists that are in AA are pretty amiable people. But all I need is my doctor and my psychiatrist. Well, now, wait a minute. Let me tell you about that. That's all right, too, but look at it like this. Now, you know what you learned at your mother's knee about Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall? And Humpty Dumpty had a great fall, and all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. Why? You remember what I said? Now, all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. Why? Well, I'll tell you why. Let's look at the doctor. All good doctors work like horses, so they are the king's horses. Let's look at psychiatrists and call them, because they're kind of snooty, the king's men, you know. So, okay, they're the king's men. So we've been going to them and going to them, but we're not being too successful. Now, what's happening? Well, same thing happened to Humpty Dumpty. You call on the king's horses and you call on the king's men, but you forgot to call on the king, baby. And you're not going to make it without it. You just don't build a bridge across the king's nose. Now, how would you like to go to a hospital and you're going to be operated on? Now, just think of this. How would you like to go to a hospital and be operated on? And this doctor comes strutting in there, you know, and he tells you, now, look, I don't believe in God. You know, I'm going to operate on you, but all I believe in, I got faith in this knife, but I ain't got no faith in God. You say, man, give me my clothes, I'm going to flip. You see, I ain't hanging around here, you know. So, hence it is, my friend. Yes, I do believe in doctors. We've got to have them. Sometimes psychiatry is necessary with the right kind of psychiatrist, but hon, I'm going to be frank with you. You've got to call on the king. See, these people, as great as they may be, they are only aides to the king. And any time the aides don't believe in the king, I mean, I don't believe in the aides, you know, and those kind of things. I don't care if it's role aides or whatever kind of aides. So, my friends, the second step, being restored to sanity. What does it mean? It simply means soundness of mind, being restored to sanity, soundness of mind. The kind of soundness, the kind of sanity that tells me that any time, any person, place, or thing is so important that I've got to drink because of that person, place, or thing, I don't need him or it. I just don't, you know. I don't need him. I don't need anything that's going to take me. He said, you know, my sobriety is the only thing that is truly mine. I brought two children into this world. I had those children. Say. But they were only lent to me for a short time. Say. We have many other things that are loaned to us for a short time. But, you know, your sobriety or my sobriety, anybody's sobriety, do you know that is the only thing that I can lay claim to that if I know is mine? Nobody can take your sobriety. Now, you don't lose your sobriety. You throw it away. You don't lose it. See, if you lose the thing, you don't know what happened. See. But if you throw something away, you know what you did with it. Have you ever had somebody come back? You know, I got drunk, but I don't know what happened. You do know what happened. You drank. That's what happened. You see? So my sobriety, nobody can steal it from me. I don't care what a person says or does or how little or how much they want to make light of me or try to hurt my feelings or ridicule me or whatever you can. I couldn't care less. Because, you see, this is mine. This is something that God gave me. And he gave it to me. So I had to work along with him. So you don't. No one can steal it from you. When you hear somebody say, oh, so-and-so made so-and-so drunk. Oh, no, he didn't make you drunk.
How in the world can I accuse you of making me drunk? Now, this is utterly impossible. You're going to make me drunk. You didn't make me sober. No. You might have helped me with God's help. But nobody ever threw me down and on the ground and threw anything and poured it down my throat. Nobody ever did that whatsoever. And we grow in this program. We grow away from the things that tend that we use as excuses that make us drunk, you know. You go away from those things. You begin to grow away. So as we travel on our journey into sobriety, we now see another beautiful sign that says, wrong way, do not enter. When one makes a decision, that third step, turn his will and his life over the care of God. Wrong way, do not enter. When I say, I've got to do it my way. Wrong way. See, I tried doing it my way. See, the big book says we thought we could find an easier, softer way. Oh, no. But one, see, I have to watch those three D's. Decision determines my destiny. Whatever decision I make every morning determines my destiny for the rest of the day. Oh, we say that third step. I know it's tough and it's rough because I cannot tell you a day in all the years that I've been in this fellowship that I have practiced it all day long, unless I was laid in the hospital flat on my back with something, you know. And then my thoughts was going somewhere else. I wish I could hurt me the hell out of here or something like that. But we have the privilege of decision. Decision. Alcohol never gave us the privilege of decision. Alcohol never permitted me to make any decision whatsoever. How many times did I not say, well, you know I can take a drink and go home. So, okay, here you are in the bar. You take a drink and go home, and on the way home, you buy a six-pack and two bottles of wine. You take them home, and you say, I got home with them, didn't I? Yeah. You got home with them. To me, this third step, it is a beautiful thing, and many times we can practice it up to the point when as long as everything is gone, great. Oh, I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Everything's going along nice, man, you know, beautiful. Mm-hmm. But let something go wrong. Oh, God don't know what he's doing. Well, I asked God for this thing, and he didn't give it to me. Well, you got the divine snub. He heard you, but he just wasn't ready to give it to you yet. But, you know, when things go wrong, that's when I need this step more than ever before. When you're riding in a plane, you got in this plane, you know, and the air is clear and it's beautiful, and you're riding along there, you know, and the person is sitting next to you, you know, you wonder, oh, you know, you're so sophisticated there. You look, I wonder what they put that crumb there next to me for. I don't want to sit next to him or her. So you start like you're reading or something, and all of a sudden you hear it come on over the intercom there, whatever it is. It says, we're going to go through some choppy weather, fasten your seatbelt. What do you do when the pilot says, we're going through some choppy weather, fasten your seatbelt? Do you say, look, I want out? Mm-hmm. No, you don't say, pilot, let me out. What do? You fasten your seatbelt tighter. And you turn to this plum next to you and say, oh, hello there. I didn't know you were here. Yeah. And you get real friendly with everybody. You know? So why can I not do that with this third step? When it gets choppy outside, fasten my seatbelt that much tighter. You know? Because this privilege of decision, and this is a privilege. Well, sometimes we think, well, I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to care of God. Big deal. Who else wants the will and the life of a drunk? I don't know if anybody else would. So for me, it is a privilege. Although I do not practice it as constantly as I should, there are many times that I have to get slapped down because I do it the wrong way. Wrong way, do not enter. When I get to thinking, you know, sometimes you've got to ace up your sleeve. Well, I've asked God for such and such a thing, but if God don't do it this way, well, then I know what else I'm going to do in case he don't. Try to ace up your sleeve, huh? Wrong way, do not enter. Drop that ace. Because, you know, I'm telling you, I've never seen it come out right yet. Not for me. It might be for somebody else. You know, I used to always plan like that. Now, just in case I'm going to ask God for such and such a thing, that it goes this way. But in case it don't go that way, I know what I'm going to do. Wrong way, do not enter.
Because, you know, I'm telling you, I've never seen it come out right yet. Not for me. It might be for somebody else. You know, I used to always plan like that. Now, just in case I'm going to ask God for such and such a thing, that it goes this way. But in case it don't go that way, I know what I'm going to do. Wrong way, do not enter. Because this beautiful third step has saved my Fanny more than one time. This is just be still and know that I am God. Just cool it, in other words. It's hard. It's awfully hard to do. I know. As we travel on our journey into sobriety, we now see a sign in the road that says road under construction. That's that fourth step where we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Road under construction. When you are taking an inventory, you had better believe the road is under construction. Now, what are some of the things that causes the road to be under construction? Well, if you people had any kind of winter, like we had last winter, it was a dump. Many times there is, or there was, immense amount of salt poured on the road. And salt has a way of eating away at the road, you know, and it causes the road to deteriorate. And when one takes an inventory, he finds that he has allowed much salt to be poured into his life, resentment. And it has eat away. And it has corroded, and it has caused me to deteriorate, that salt. That salt that came from cowardice. That salt where I couldn't say anything, I just let it build up and build up. And it eat away at me, and it eat away at me, because I wasn't woman enough to take care of the situation as I should. Because I was too busy lying, I was too busy stealing, I was too busy, shall we say, justifying everything that I did. Salt built up. I resented people that were staying sober. I resented people that didn't have a problem. I resented everything. And then again, another thing that causes the road to be under construction. After many times we've had very severe weather, we find holes in the road. And in taking a searching and fearless moral inventory, I find holes in my life. Emptiness. Emptiness. Oh my God, this emptiness in my life. How did this ever happen? How did my life ever become so full of holes, so empty? Because by the use of alcohol, everything that was good I took out of it. And alcohol left the hole. All the times that I should have been spending, doing something decent, or spending at home, you know, I used that time for drinking. Then finally, there's an emptiness there. People begin to move out of your life. That leaves an emptiness there. And every time you begin to back off from decent jobs, and there's an emptiness there. And what do you fill up all that emptiness with? Alcohol. Alcohol. Now, what am I going to fill it up with now? Just, you don't see anybody out there when the road is under construction filling up those holes with ashes. You don't see anybody out there filling them up, shall we say, with sand. They've got to put something concrete in there. And that's why you and I come to AA. That's why you and I associate with one another. You know? That's why you and I read that big book. That's why you and I look at that 12 and 12. That's why you and I need that day-by-day book there, you know. That one day at a time, whatever you call it, you need that. That gives me the proper material. Just talking with you. It gives me the proper material to fill up them holes with. No longer am I preoccupied with drinking. Because you give me some material to fill up those holes with. When I get out on my knees at night and say, Lord, what will you have me do? It's giving me something to fill up those holes with. It's giving me the concrete that I need to pour in there. And then again, change of temperature causes the road to be under construction. Turning from hot to cold too quickly causes the road to buckle a bit. And you know how you and I were when I look at my inventory, that change of temperature that I had. From one day, everything is just fine. Anything anybody says is okay. 5 minutes later, everything is all wrong. Change of temperature. One thing has suited me, and the minute I find something and I get interested in that, I throw that away. That's no good. Never being able to be satisfied from hot to cold. Why? That's why I must take a searching and fearless small inventory of myself. Sometimes we say, well, you know, that's a hard thing to do. I don't need to take an inventory. I'm not drinking now, so I don't need. You just can't throw a silk blanket over a mule and make a racehorse out of him, you know. You just can't do that, you know. But, so I do need to take an inventory.
Searching and fearless. And if I will be fearless about it, I don't have to search very long. Fearless means be honest about this inventory that I'm going to take. It doesn't mean that I got to set up and hit myself upside the head with a 2x4 all the time. No. Mm-mm. Inventory means to me to look at me. Yeah. See, the big book tells me that drinking is just a symptom of what's really wrong with me. And I got to find out what it is. I got to find out about that salt on the road. Yeah. I got to find out about the holes in the road. And how do I start out with my inventory? I start out with what I got on hand right now. What is this bugging me right now? There's no need of me worrying about something that happened 20 years ago and I got something bugging the hell out of me right now. Let me get rid of this first. Because you told me in this program, first things first. And if I start with what's bugging me right now, get that out of the way. Because if I'm going to think of something that happened 40 years ago and I can't concentrate on what happened 40 years ago if I got something bugging me right now, I got to take care of that. So sometimes we might think and take an inventory. Now, wait a minute. What brought on this last drunk? This makes it very easy. Well, I know I went on one of them jealous binges of mine. Oh, so you're jealous, huh? Well, when did that start? And you stop to think, well, hell, I've been jealous all my life. So searching and filling a small inventory. You didn't have to search very far. I just got honest about it. That was all. Well, I don't know how to go. No, yes, you do. It's very simple. What'd you get jealous of? Well, you know, after all, I am a very possessive person. Well, why are you so possessive? Because I feel insecure, you know. And on down the line, this is very simple. But it starts out with being fearless. Just be honest about it. There's no need to be, you know. As what's that new word now that they use in all these high-class places? Your modality is different. Ain't that a duck? Your modality. Ain't that a duck? I ain't got no modality like other people, though. See, I just got inventory. As we travel on our journey into sobriety, we see a sign in the road that says, slow, do not pass. Admitted to God, ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Exact nature. Slow, do not pass. I know you've seen that sign, slow, but don't pass it. See, I said, I will never, as long as I live, take the fifth step. And my sponsor says, oh, yes, you will. When the pain hurts long enough and strong enough, you'll take it. And I'm glad she told it to me the way that she did. And I'm glad that Almighty God has revealed it to be the way that he has and the way that he does. Slow, do not pass. You know, sometimes after taking an inventory, and sometimes after being, we want back in the good graces of people so quickly, that what will we do? Oh, yes, we will admit to a whole lot of stuff. That's not necessary. Those are the steps say, the exact nature of our wrongs. Exactly what's wrong. Exact nature. What are they talking about? Motive. My motive. You know, there are many times that we might have gotten into a lot of trouble. And you say, I know I've been a terrible person. I did this and I did that. Oh, yes, you know. But what was your motive for doing it? Did you do it just because you're all that lustful or just because you're all that gluttonous? Why did I do it? Well, we might examine ourselves and say, well, the exact nature of my wrongs was because of my drinking, I had withdrawn from everything that was decent. And I found myself that I was in an extremely lonely position, very lonely. You see, loneliness has caused more poverty, has caused really more crime than poverty ever dreamed of. Loneliness causes the poverty of the soul. Yeah. And you and I can get into conditions like that. Well, I know, but I did thus and so forth. But what was the exact name? What was the motive? You didn't do that to hurt somebody. In many instances, you didn't. But out of loneliness, you can get into a hell of a lot of trouble. Yeah? Many times, you know, we do many things from spite. You know, that hurts like the claws of an eagle. Spite. The exact nature. Why would I want to spite you? Because I felt inferior. But most of the times when we hunt down, seek out, we will find
There's that lonely sickness. You know, alcohol has been called the lonely sickness, and it is. And you know how we try to bear it out. I don't need anybody. I don't want anybody. And your heart is crying all the time, oh, God, please love me. Please let somebody love me. Instead of us crying and saying, oh, God, please let me love somebody. But you don't fade to ask, can I love somebody? They might hurt me. I can't afford that. And if they love me, they might find out that they might find out I'm human because I might love in return and I'm superior to other people. I can't let you know that I have an emotion like love. If I do, you might get even with me. Because why? I haven't examined myself very well. I'm afraid to let you know that I can love. Why? Well, you might hurt me, and then I couldn't take that, and so forth and so on. Because I'm thinking, I haven't changed my thinking. I'm only thinking one way. The only way, I'm still using that old alcoholic thinking. I know good and well, if I love you, or you love me the way I love you, I know what I'd do to you. I'd make you suffer. Yeah. And until I change my thinking and change my actions, see, then I don't have to worry about that lonely sickness. But there's got to be a change. And along with change, there must be responsibility. Am I responsible? Am I going to be responsible now for my actions? And as we travel on our journey into sobriety, we now see a sign in the road that says detour. Entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Detour. You know, again, entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Detour. What do you mean, detour? These things that I know that are my character defects, these things that I know that are going to get me in trouble, I'm going to try to detour. I must go around those things. I must go over those things. I must be big enough to go over those things. But, you know, sometimes we figure, well, you know, I don't want God to remove all my character defects. Why? I need them. Now, I know that I have a sharp tongue, and I know that I have this and I have that, you know, and if God takes that away from me, well, why don't you want him to take it away? Well, you see, I'm afraid, there you go. I'm afraid if he does, then, you know, people will take advantage of me. So, okay, if I'm holding on to one, I hold on to three. All right, so I got a nasty temper. Now, I don't want God to do anything about it because the temper's one. I'm afraid people will take advantage of me. Okay, so what have I got? I got a nasty temper and I got fear. Because I am afraid. Lack of faith right there. Now, the big book says, you know, we thought we could hold on to our old ideas. And the result was nil until we let go absolutely. And sometimes even with character defects, we think, well, I'm going to hold on to this one. But, you know, you just can't. Well, one has to detour. You know, maybe before, you may be going down the road and it would tell you to detour, that the bridge had a big storm and the bridge is washed out. And you'd say, oh, well, I know the bridge got washed out before and I made it through. Maybe the water's a little bit higher this time and you won't make it through. And you know, we don't have to worry so much about if we're trying to practice this program. But there's a lot of character defects, you know, that automatically take care of themselves that you just don't need anymore. Now, why do I need? Here's three that leaves, right quick. You're entirely ready to have God remove them. And they are removed. Many of them are removed when you put the top on that bottle and leave it on there. You don't have to lie about things anymore. No, we're not drinking. You don't have to steal anymore. You know how you steal from yourself? That's the kind of steal I'm talking about. You don't have to steal out of your kid's bank. You don't have to steal out of your husband's wallet or your wife's pocketbook. You don't have to steal anymore. You ask for what you want. You know? You don't have to lie and say that you buried your grandmother six times. You don't have to do that, you know. You get off from work. You know? You go to the boss and say, I don't feel well. You don't have to lie and have somebody call up and say, I got the flu. Because you don't have the flu. You just say, look, I'm feeling pretty rough today and I won't be in today. So there's a character defect that's taken care of. You don't have to hide. You don't have to hide things anymore because you're not bringing things home that you have to hide anymore. But, so there's that lying and that stealing and being preoccupied and all that kind of stuff. See, those character defects will take care of themselves. So there are some I don't have to worry about. You see, God makes it awful easy for us. You know, if we'll just come straight.
And then again, as we travel on our journey into sobriety, we see a sign in the road. And this is a small sign, but do you know they carry an awful lot of weight? If you will look at that seventh step, that is the smallest of all steps. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. But it is of great significance. You see a sign on the road that says bumps and curves. Those are small words. But they're dynamite, aren't they? Because humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. You see, these shortcomings are the clothespins that hold resentments on the line. And I have got to watch it. This is a detonator that sets off the bomb of these shortcomings. These little bitty things. Three that I found that stand out: pretense, procrastination, and reservation. Oh, don't they stand out? Pretense. Pretense that I am staying sober for me, and I am not. I am staying sober only to further my greediness or my ambition. I am staying sober only long enough to get what I want. Pretense. That's a bad thing. See, that's holding on to mole ideas, isn't it? Pretend. Pretending to be someone that I am not can get me into a lot of trouble. Procrastination. Oh, brother, that's a rough one. Always putting it off. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. You see, these things that lead back to my character defects, that's what they are. Because, see, once I have found, someone has found me out, when I don't get what I want, I'm going to get angry and I'm going to blow my top. So they're going to find out. See, that was my character defect. That anger and blowing the top goes right back to the sixth step. It was a character defect. And the shortcoming was pretending that it didn't exist because I was only hanging out there for something else. Procrastination. Well, you know, I'm going to AA as soon as I get my license back. And I'm going to go to AA then. I would go now, but I have to get my license back. If you wanted to drink, you'd go get them without any license, wouldn't you? You know, I would go to AA, you know, if I had something to wear, oh, we girls love to say that. If I had, well, what did you wear that night you did the striptease? What did you wear that night? You know, well, I would go to AA, but I'll tell you one thing. Now, I'm not going to drink, but there's a couple of more parties I want to go to. But you weren't going to drink, but it's just a couple of more parties. In other words, you weren't going to drink, but just in case they pushed you too far. Yeah. I got a couple of more. Well, I would go, but you know, I've been in the hospital and I want to get reacquainted with my family before I start going to AA. Reacquainted, and your family knows all about you, you know. They know you only too well. I would go to AA, but I don't have anybody to keep the kids. That's good. Who kept them when you was on the couch drunk? They kept you, didn't they? Yeah. And you know, I'll tell you another thing. This is one of the things, you know, that today is so prevalent. Well, when are you going to tell your doctor that you are an alcoholic? Well, I don't know, but I'm just taking these pills now. And just as soon as I get over the hump, I'm going to tell him that all that Valium and Librium and all that crap people say can nowadays. Well, I don't know, just as soon as I get over the hump and my life gets smoothed out, I'm going to tell my doctor that I'm an alcoholic and not to give me these things. Well, now, wait a minute. How about looking at it a little bit different than that? Well, I can't give them up now. You know, I'm tired of laying there at night counting sheep. I can't sleep, so I lay there at night and count sheep. Well, you know, I got a little something I want to say. You know, if you talk to the shepherds, you don't have to count sheep. You know, you really don't. You really don't. So, just say, Lord, look, I don't want to go to sleep right now. I just don't want to go to sleep right now. Then, I don't know, read it. If it's after 12, well, then, you know, read the 24-hour book, you know. Get ahead of them for that day. Read it ahead of time. And then another one, there's that reservation. Oh, brother, that's a shortcoming. And it leads back to my character defect. It can't happen to me. You know, because I'll tell you why it can't happen to me, you know. I'm just on a different level than so-and-so. I don't think my drinking was that bad, and I'm just not on the same level that he is on. Well, you know, you write the word level down and look at it. It spells the same way backwards as it does forward. Level is level, honey. You know, it really does, you know. And then, you know, I doubt seriously whether I'm an alcoholic because there were no alcoholics in my family. Well, you know, you trick them. You be the first. You know, it's a... And then, you know, I have a reservation about being an alcoholic because, you know, after all, you know, I never left the church. Well, neither did a priest. He's still here every day saying mass, but he's still an alcoholic, you know. And then I'll tell you another thing, you know, I don't think I need to go to AA because, you know, I'm in therapy. Oh, brother. Sometimes the therapist needs to be there, too, you know. One of those kind of things. Well, I'm in therapy, you know, and after all, she and I, now this is just one person that you're talking to, you know. And that one person does not have all the answers. No one person has all the answers. So, but, you know, I'll tell you one thing. You know, I think I'm going to go into therapy myself real soon. You know, it's a damn shame. It really and truly is. There was a time when a person came in to AA and they said, look, stay with us 6 months, and if you don't like us, we'll refund all your misery. Now a person comes into AA, and you say, well, look, if you don't like us, we'll make a therapist out of you, and you can screw up everybody, you know. Yeah. And that happens, too, you know. And then again, you might say, then you get to be one. You say, well, you know, maybe you do turn out pretty fair. So, well, you know, I've gone to school now. You know, I don't need all of that because now I have a degree. Oh, Lord, have mercy. I have a degree. And so, you know, I don't need to go back to AA because I have a degree and I can help them, and I can help everybody. A degree. That's really, some thermometers have degrees, too, you know. And let me tell you about that also. But it don't make any difference whether you've got a Ph.D. or an M.D. or a V.D. or whatever you got. Unless you have got that person's welfare at heart, you can do the same thing that you do with some thermometers. Shove it. You know? Because we are in the people business. You know? That's it. So as we travel on our journey into sobriety, we now see a sign in the road that says, watch for ice on the bridge. You know, that takes care of steps 8 and 9, you know. When it comes down to amends, that we made a list of all persons we've harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Watch for ice on the bridge. Because that is why we beg of you. Please try to have a good spiritual foundation. Because not every time, but I hope it never happens to anybody here. And I hope it never has and never will. But sometimes there is ice on that bridge. Not everybody says, oh, darling, I'm so glad that you're sober. I'm so glad. I'll come back to my arms. A lot of people say, beat it. You know? Yeah. You know, there's a very thin line between humility and stupidity at times. A very thin line. Sometimes we want to be back into people's good graces so badly that we start making amends, you know, for things that we didn't even down do. And we will take things upon our shoulders and say, oh, yes, you know, just anything, let me be back in again. And, you know, you see, don't do that, for the simple reason is, after you get good and sober, you're going to resent that you did it. Then the person will say, you know, you promised to do this and this thing if I let you back. You know, one of those kind of things. The big book tells me that I do not become a doormat for anybody. I must not be. Sure, I believe in amends. See, there's a difference between restitution and amends. I mean real amends. Well, you say, I sent them a gift. That's not it. A gift is only an apology for the amend that I'm not big enough to make. See, I have to bring myself. That's when I make amends. Amends is made with the heart. Restitution is made with the hands. You can be made to make restitution. But it says became willing, and that has to start right up here in becoming willing. And sometimes, because I am so full of remorse, and because I hate myself so badly, and I haven't forgiven myself,
you know.
And I want someone to love me so badly
that I will admit to anything, and that's stupid.
Amend so I can live in peace with myself. Amend so I can walk with my fellow man. Amend so I can get down on my knees and look up to my God and thank him. Amend. Yes, I must make amends for my sake, too. If I do not make amends, then I am still in bondage. I am now in bondage to the person that I have hurt. Because every time I see him, I'm going to try to cut him down or slice him or get out of their way or do something, and I'm in bondage. This person is making me do something that I don't want to do. And I'm still in one bondage leads to the other bondage. And this program was designed for me to be free. Why is it designed for me to be free? Because, you know, most of you people here, I think a great many of you might have children, and you don't want your children in bondage. Because you say, that is my son or that is my daughter, and I don't want that person in bondage. Well, you see, my father is not a king. My father is the king. You know, the king. And I am his royal subject. You know, and he wants me to be free. And I cannot bring all royal subjects, you know, carried messages for their father. And I cannot carry you a message if I am half slave. I must be free. And therefore, I cannot go to bed at night with a face on my pillow and wake up with that same face in my plate. And I have straightened that mess out because then I am in bondage. And that same face, when I get ready to talk to my father, to get the message from him, it's going to come between me and him, and I cannot afford that. I must be free. You see, I also must remember, maybe I won't. Maybe not everybody's going to say, oh, everything's beautiful. I have to remember that I, too, any time I got the chance, I made people crawl through. I must remember that. Any time I got that chance, if I could just stick it in and break it off, so sometime, you know, after watch Christ on the bridge, if it doesn't happen to you. But when it does, and if it does, if I have a good spiritual foundation, I might slide a little, but I ain't going to slip. And I won't fall. Because he promised me that I wouldn't fall. So as we travel on our journey into sobriety, we now see a sign in the road that says no U-turn. Continue to take personal inventory. And when we were wrong, promptly admit it. No U-turn. None whatsoever. Now, what are we talking about? Continue to take personal inventory. Now, along with that sign where it says no U-turn, you might also see another sign that says for authorized vehicles only. That's where people would come in the program and say, well, you know, I know it all now. I've had my course in AA. I'm going to leave now, you know. Well, he's authorized to go. We'll wait till he comes back. He'll be back, you know, in those times. They'll bring him back, or, you know, if he can make it back. He's authorized. But this sign that says no U-turn, what are some of the things that might cause a person to make that U-turn? Well, sickness is one. He said, well, you know, after all, I got sick, and then I was feeling so bad. Well, you know, that 10th step, continued to take inventory, and when we were wrong, probably admitted, hell, I was sick before I came in here. But I'm still sick, for as that's concerned. Well, you know, I came down with the flu, and I just had to take me a little bit. Oh, so-and-so was so sick, and they were suffering, and I couldn't stand to see so-and-so suffer, so I just had to take a drink so both of you could suffer, you know, and those kind of things, you know. And then, you know, a U-turn again, so... But, you know, here I was. I lost my job. That's why I got drunk. All the time that I was drinking, I never lost my job. Now I'm sober and I lost my job. Well, maybe you're just using that as an excuse to get drunk anyway. You wanted to get rid of the job, but you didn't have guts enough to quit it because you didn't think you could get another one. So, okay, you screwed around and got fired. Now you use that as an excuse to get drunk. You didn't want the job anyway. You was hoping something would happen. Yeah. So you get out of it. Now you can come home, you know, and cry on somebody. I lost my job. But you hated the damn job all the time. You're hoping you'd get fired. But you say, I don't want to quit because then I don't have guts enough to look for another one. So, but if I get fired, then that's an excuse. I get drunk and have work for nobody then. You know, that's fine. That's no excuse. God's opportunity, you know. Man's adversity is God's opportunity. Sometimes you lose your job, it's the best thing ever happened to you because God's got something better for you to do anyway. And then again, here we come on. Well, you know, here I was doing fine. I thought I was getting along fine, and they shoved them divorce papers under my nose. Time for me to go out and get drunk.
rejoice and be exceedingly glad. No, I don't mean it that way. But that,
if I get drunk because some divorce papers were stuffed up under my nose, I'm playing right into that person's hands. It's
See? I knew you wasn't going to stay sober no how.
Well, I stayed sober, and you said you served those papers on me well. I knew you was going to get drunk.
That's why I served them on you. I will not play into your hands. No. Whatever it is, remember, man's adversity is God's opportunity, as far as that's concerned.
And then you said, well, you know, after all, I kept going to the program, and I kept going to those meetings, and I went out and got drunk because I got bored. Oh, you got bored.
Oh, you wouldn't go out and buy a stick of dynamite if you got constipated, would you?
And then again, sometimes we make that U-turn because lack for lack of attention. You see, when you first come in the program, everybody's hugging you and kissing you and loving you and all that kind of stuff, and you feel all great. But now, another new person comes in the program. You know, it's just like a lady, when a woman, when she goes to the hospital, you know, and she has a baby. She's already got little old so-and-so here. He's 3 years old. He was the baby, and everything was fine. He was loved and petted and all like that. Now, Mama goes to the hospital, and she brings another little baby home. And all the new attention is on the new baby. Well, now, here stands little Gerald, or whatever his name is. And everybody's pampering the baby and putting diapers on little Gerald. You know, he's used to all this. He said, what the hell's happening here? I used to get all the attention. So he figures, I'll fix him. I'm going to piss on myself. He's been house broke, see. He wants some attention. And sometimes we act the very same way. A new person comes in. See, what Mama should have did was say, I'm bringing your little brother or sister home, and I want you to help me with it. Because, see, you ever see two kids, little kids playing with one another? Sometimes a little child can understand what another little kid's saying, And you don't understand. You know, it's like I used to say to my son sometimes. I said, Mike, what is Leslie saying? You know, he could understand, and I couldn't. And he'd tell me, she said, this is interesting. You ever see two children playing together? They understand what one another's talking about. And you don't. It's just like sometimes when a brand new person comes in the program, this other person's been around, say, maybe 6 months or a year or something. You know, maybe he can identify with him better than he could with somebody like me. But, you know, I need to be there anyhow. But, you know, so I can say, well, what's he saying? And see that you're saying the right thing back to him, too, yeah. As far as that is concerned. But then, nevertheless, that lack of attention. Well, they don't love me like they used to. Yes, we love you. And we need you here to help that new person when they, to help us with that new person when they come in. And then again, another thing that might cause, shall we say, a U-turn, is when we're going to straighten out the whole world. Because I'm sober, I'm going to straighten out the mailman, the milkman, the dog catcher, and everybody else. They got to see it my way. No, they don't. When they need me, they'll ask to see me. They will need me. When they need me, they'll ask to see me. In other words, just be there. And then again, you know, when one travels on this journey into sobriety, as he begins to, there's times that he begins to get a little tired and leisure, but rest is good. Rest is very good. And you see that sign as you drive along, and it says, gas, food, and lodging. Looks like it. And you say, oh, I'm tired. Doesn't that sign look good? Thought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. Praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. That's that beautiful 11th step. You know? Gas, food, and lodging. What am I talking about? In the first step, did I not say that I was powerless? In the second step, I came to believe that there was power, and in the third and from there on in, I began to utilize it. That's the game. Food. Spiritual food. Thought through prayer and meditation. Spiritual food. Lodging, AA. You see, as long as I live and as long as I stay in AA, I will constantly be in the recovery room. You know, when one has had a terrific operation, he's brought out of the operating room and he's placed in the recovery room where there is a very efficient nurse that is constantly taking his vital signs, you know, and at the slightest provocation there, she will go and call a physician. You see, I like to feel that I too am in this recovery room.
and that my pulse, my respiration, you know, and blood pressure are constantly being taken. What are the four vital signs of the alcoholic? My four vital signs. Pride, fear, resentment, and self-pity. Those are my four vital signs. And, you know, I don't need to have anybody else run to the physician for me. I can call him myself. See, you and I have had one of the greatest operations that anybody could possibly have. There is no human hand that could give us the operation that we've had, a personality operation. There is no one on the face of this earth. You know, it's like somebody says, oh, but did you ever read Freud? I said, what group does he belong to? Don't you know? See, we have been given an operation by the grace of all physicians. That's it. And when we look at this 11th step, where one thoughts is prayer, meditation improves conscious contact with God. Only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. You see, you know, you and I realize, whether it be alcohol or whatever it is, each and every day when one goes out, he finds his Goliath out there. There's always something out there, whether it is alcohol or whatever it is. That prayer and meditation is so important. See, you remember the story about David? See, each day you and I have our Goliath to slay. David went out there with his slingshot. And there was Goliath out there raising more hell than one-legged man at the dance, you know. And David's brothers wanted to put an armor on him, and they wanted to give him a sword and a shield. And David says, look, I don't want all that. That's too heavy. You know, many times when we first come in AA, somebody's going to come up to you, and they're going to tell you, oh, no, no, that AA's all right, but I got something else. No, wait a minute, what? Well, now, I want you to come over here, and I want you to go to this, and I got TM, I got TE, I got this, I got that. I mean, wait a minute, that's too heavy for me. I'm just like David. I don't hang all that on me. It's too heavy for me right now. I'm not talking about you, I'm talking about Holly. Now, I don't care what you hang on you, I'm talking about what's wrong on me. See, I don't need all of these outside things to confuse me. I'm confused enough as it is. You know? And I'm like David. If I go out each and every day, let me go out in the grace of God. See, when David went out there, and there was Goliath out there raising all that hell, you know, and all David had was his slingshot. And, you know, Goliath got stoned, you know, it is, you know. But, you know, you and I realize that it was not the feeble force that David had behind that slingshot that killed Goliath, but it was the power behind that feeble force that tore Goliath all to pieces. And I don't care about all these other newfangled things that come along. I'm not saying that they're no good. I say they're no good for me, that you have it for me. The big book is the answer. That's it for me. You are the answer. Because you have walked that walk and you can talk that talk. And here's somebody else going to come along, you know, that wants to make some money. You see, there was a time nobody wanted to be bothered with the alcoholic. Nobody. I don't care who he was. And all of a sudden, you know, they found out, there's gold in them dry hills, you know. And now, when you let some of these agencies or governments or whatever it is withdraw some of them funds, they're going to send every one of them right back to us, you know, one of those kind of things. Now, AA is wonderful in some places. Now, it don't make any difference whether he's an alcoholic or what he is. Whether if the welfare gets hold of them, oh, just send them to AA. They're wonderful people. You know, don't care. That, you know, maybe they don't have any alcoholic club. Send them to us because they don't know what to do with them. So send them over to AA. You know, they don't know what to do with them. You know, maybe if it's what it is, send it to AA. Just send it on over there. Yeah. Because we don't know how to handle it, but we ain't going to tell you we don't know how to handle it, you know. So you handle it for us. But you know, my friends, this is God's program. He is still the one authority, the one authority. Because, you know, regardless of who comes around or who comes in or whatever it is, if they're not one of us, they're not going to stay anyway. We don't have to raise our voice or raise our hand or do anything. All we have to do is hold out a hand. And if they're not one of us, because, you know, I'm going to tell you something. If I hadn't have been an alcoholic, ain't no way in hell I'd put up with you people for 20 years, you know? And I know you wouldn't put up with me. But you see, my friend, this is the way it goes when I look at this beautiful 11th step, you know? Because if something else regards to how good you may feel or how secure that you may feel in your recovery room, you know, there's always, I can remember one of the most beautiful sights I ever saw in my life, and I thought about this beautiful 11th step. I was traveling down the Massachusetts Turnpike one day, and I thought to myself, all of this beauty, all of this majesty, and I thought of the beautiful 11th step where one sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. And I said, this is so beautiful, God. You know, there's always something. Life is like that. When you think everything is great, there's always going to be something that's going to snatch you back out of that lethargy. Because I looked around, there was a sign that says, watch the fallen rock. And that broke it up. And it'll be the same thing. You got to watch the fallen rock, even though we think everything is going along gorgeous, everything's beautiful, everything's great. Finally, you can get hurt. Here's the fallen rock. Just when you think you got it made, isn't it? You know, you ain't a damn bit better than you was when you was drunk. In fact, I thought you acted better when you was drunk than you do now. Brother, that's a fallen rock, you know. All right, so you go to AA, and sometimes people there get a little bit upset. Well, you know, I didn't think he comes for the coffee and donuts anyhow. I don't think he comes for anything else. That's a fallen rock. So, okay, because he don't say nothing. So he talks, well, he's talking too much, y'all to shut him up. Okay. So he don't say nothing. He's a snob. No, that's a fallen rock. Okay. Well, you see, he's always hanging around the women. He's a playboy. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, if you're a woman, you always hang around the men. She ain't no good. Okay, so she stops hanging around all the men, and she starts talking to the women. I believe she's a lesbian, so she ain't no good. Watch for falling out. You're going to get it. But, you know, so it has to be. Aren't you glad you got a God of your understanding? Nevertheless. So now as we travel on our journey into sobriety, we now see a sign in the road that says, end of divided highway, merging traffic. Yeah. End of divided highway. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result, as a way as a result of these steps, we try to carry the message of the practice principles in all of our affairs. End of divided highway. I can no longer have two kinds of honesty. I can only have one kind of honesty. Yeah. And not an honesty at work and an honesty at AA. Yeah. That's it. Merging traffic, which means I must practice these principles in all my affairs with all people. And how does one practice these principles? With all people in all these affairs. Love mercy, do justly, walk humbly before your God. Thank you.